worse. Now humans need to know about this knife thing. And Eric can't be around during the day, so you'll have Eric free time to think. Also, he's got his own business to run, and he's not going to be following you around. And the new vampire execs have to leave you alone because they want to keep Eric happy. Not so bad, right? She smiled at me, and after a second, I smiled back. I began to perk up. Thanks, Tara, I said. You think Sam will stop being mad? I wouldn't exactly expect him to apologize for saying you acted like an idiot, Tara warned me. A, it's true, and B, he's a man. He's got that chromosome. But you two have always gotten along great, and he owes you for taking care of the bar, so he'll come around. I pitched my used Kleenex into the little trash can by the table. I smiled, though it probably wasn't my best effort. Meanwhile, Tara said, I have some news for you, too. She took a deep breath. What is it? I asked, delighted that we were back on best friend footing. I'm going to have a baby, Tara said, and her face froze in a grimace. Uh-oh, dangerous footing. You don't look super happy, I said cautiously. I hadn't planned on having children at all, she said, which was okay with JB. So? Well, even multiple birth control methods don't always work, Tara said, looking down at her hands, which were folded on top of a bridal magazine. And I just can't have it taken care of. It's ours. So, might you come around to being glad about this? She tried to smile. JB is really happy. It's hard for him to keep it a secret, but I wanted to wait for the first 3 months to pass. You're the first one I've told. I swear, I said, reaching over to pat her shoulder, you'll be a good mother. You really think so? She looked and felt terrified. Tara's folks had been the kind of parents who occasionally get shotgunned by their offspring. Tara's abhorrence of violence had prevented her from taking that path, but I don't think anyone would have been surprised if the older Thorntons had vanished one night. A few people would have applauded. Yeah, I really think so. I meant it. I could hear, directly from her head, Tara's determination to wipe out everything her own mother had done to her by being the best mother she could be to her own child. In Tara's case, that meant she would be sober, gentle-handed, clean of speech, and full of praise. I'll show up at every classroom open house and teacher conference, she said, now in a voice that was almost frightening in its intensity. I'll bake brownies. My child will have new clothes. Her shoes will fit. She'll get her shots, and she'll get her braces. We'll start a college fund next week. I'll tell her I love her every damn day. If that wasn't a great plan for being a good mother, I couldn't imagine what a better one could be. We hugged each other when I got up to leave. This is the way it's supposed to be, I thought. I went home, ate a belated lunch, and changed into my work clothes. When the phone rang, I hoped it was Sam calling to smooth things over, but the voice on the other end was an older man's and unfamiliar.
Hello? Is Octavia Fant there, please?
No, sir, she's out. May I take a message?
If you would.
Sure. I'd answered the phone in the kitchen, so there was a pad and pencil handy.
Please tell her Lewis Chambers called. Here's my number.
He gave it to me slowly and carefully, and I repeated it to make sure I'd put it down correctly.
Ask her to call me, please. I'll be glad to take a collect call.
I'll make sure she gets your message.
Thank you.
I couldn't read thoughts over the phone, which normally I considered a great relief, but I would have enjoyed learning a little more about Mr. Chambers. When Amelia came home a little after 5, Octavia was in the car. I gathered Octavia had been walking around downtown Bon Ton filling out job applications while Amelia had put in an afternoon at the insurance agency. It was Amelia's evening to cook, and though I had to leave for Merlot's in a few minutes, I enjoyed watching her leap into action, creating spaghetti sauce. I handed Octavia her message while Amelia was chopping onions and a bell pepper. Octavia made a choked sound and grew so still that Amelia stopped chopping and joined me in waiting for the older woman to look up from the piece of paper and give us a little backstory. That didn't happen. After a moment, I realized Octavia was crying, and I hurried to my bedroom and got a tissue. I tried to slip it to Octavia tactfully, like I hadn't noticed anything amiss, but just happened to have an extra Kleenex in my hand. Amelia carefully looked down at the cutting board and resumed chopping, while I glanced at the clock and began fishing around in my purse for my car keys, taking lots of unnecessary time to do it.
"Did he sound well?" Octavia asked, her voice choked.
"Yes," I said. There was only so much I could get from a voice on the other end of a phone line. "He sounded anxious to talk to you."
"Oh, I have to call him back," she said, and her voice was wild.
"Sure," I said. "Just punch in the number. Don't worry about calling collect or anything. The phone bill will let us know how much it was." I glanced over at Amelia, cocking an eyebrow. She shook her head. She didn't know what the hell was going on either. Octavia placed the call with shaking fingers. She pressed the phone to her ear after the first ring. I could tell when Lewis Chambers answered. Her eyes shut tight, and her hand clenched the phone so hard the muscles stood out.
"Oh, Lewis,"
she said, her voice full of raw relief and amazement.
"Oh, thank God. Are you all right?"
Amelia and I shuffled out of the kitchen at that point. Amelia walked to my car with me. "You ever heard of this Lewis guy?" I asked. "She never talked about her private life when she was working with me, but other witches told me Octavia had a steady boyfriend. She hasn't mentioned him since she's been here. It looks like she hasn't heard from him since Katrina." "She might not have thought he survived," I said, and we widened our eyes at each other.
"That's big stuff," Amelia said.
"Well, we may be losing Octavia." She tried to stifle her relief, but of course I could read it. As fond as Amelia was of her magical mentor, I'd realized that for Amelia, living with Octavia was like living with one of your junior high teachers. "I got to go," I said. "Keep me posted. Text me if there's any big news." Texting was one of my new Amelia-taught skills. Despite the chilly air, Amelia sat on one of the lawn chairs that we'd recently hauled out of the storage shed to encourage ourselves to anticipate spring. "The minute I know something," she agreed, "I'll wait here a few minutes, then go check on her." I got in my car and hoped the heater would warm up soon. In the gathering dusk, I drove to Merlot's. I saw a coyote on the way. Usually they were too clever to be seen, but this one was trotting along the side of the road as if he had an appointment in town. Maybe it was really a coyote, or maybe it was a person in another form. When I considered the possums and coons and the occasional armadillo I saw squashed by the road every morning, I wondered how many were-creatures had gotten killed in their animal forms in such careless ways. Maybe some of the bodies the police labeled murder victims were actually people killed by accident in their alternate form. I remembered all animal traces had vanished from Crystal's body when she'd been taken down from the cross after the nails had been removed. I was willing to bet those nails had been silver. There was so much I didn't know. When I came in Merlot's back door, full of plans to reconcile with Sam, I found my boss having an argument with Bobby Burnham. It was almost dark now, and Bobby should be off the clock. Instead, he was standing in the hall outside of Sam's office. He was red in the face and fit to be tied. "What's up?" I said. "Bobby, did you need to talk to me?"
"Yeah, this guy wouldn't tell me when you were going to get here," Bobby said.
"This guy is my boss, and he isn't obliged to tell you anything," I said. "Here I am.
What do you need to say to me?
Eric sent you this card, and he ordered me to tell you I'm at your disposal whenever you need me. I'm supposed to wash your car if you want me to.
Bobby's face went even redder as he said this. If Eric had thought Bobby would be made humble and compliant after a public humiliation, he was nuts. Now Bobby would hate me for 100 years, if he lived that long. I took the card Bobby handed me and said, "Thanks, Bobby. Go back to Shreveport." Before the last syllable left my mouth, Bobby was out the back door. I examined the plain white envelope and then stuck it in my purse. I looked up to meet Sam's eyes.
"Like you needed another enemy," he said, and stomped into his office.
Like I needed another friend acting like an asshole, I thought. So much for us having a good laugh over our disagreement. I followed Sam in to drop my purse in the drawer he kept empty for the barmaids. We didn't say a word to each other. I went to the storeroom to get an apron. Antoine was changing his stained apron for a clean one.
"Derek bumped into me with a jar full of jalapenos and the juice slopped out," he said. "I can't stand the smell of them."
"Woo," I said, catching a whiff. "I don't blame you."
"Sam's mama doing okay?"
"Yeah, she's out of the hospital," I said.
"Good news."
As I tied the strings around my waist, I thought Antoine was about to say something else, but if he was, he changed his mind. He crossed the hall to knock on the kitchen door, and Derek opened it from the inside and let him in. People had wandered into the kitchen by mistake too often, and the door was kept locked all the time. There was another door from the kitchen that led directly out back, and the dumpster was right outside. I walked past Sam's office without looking in. He didn't want to talk to me. Okay, I wouldn't talk to him. I realized I was being childish. The FBI agents were still in bon ton, which shouldn't have surprised me. Tonight, they came into the bar. Weiss and Letesta were sitting opposite each other in a booth, a pitcher of beer and a basket of French fried pickles between them, and they were talking intently. And at a table close to them, looking regal and beautiful and remote, was my great-grandfather, Niall Brigant. This day was going to win a prize for most peculiar. I blew out a puff of air and went to wait on my great-grandfather first. He stood as I approached. His pale, straight hair was tied back at the nape of his neck. He was wearing a black suit and a white shirt, as he always did. Tonight, instead of the solid black tie he usually wore, he had on a tie I'd given him for Christmas. It was red, gold, and black striped, and he looked spectacular. Everything about him gleamed and shone. The shirt wasn't simply white, it was snowy and starched, and his coat wasn't just black, it was spotlessly inky. His shoes showed not a speck of dust, and the myriad of fine, fine wrinkles in his handsome face only set off its perfection and his brilliant green eyes. His age enhanced rather than diminished his looks. It almost hurt to look at him. Niall put his arms around me and kissed my cheek.
"Blood of my blood," he said,
and I smiled into his chest. He was so dramatic, and he had such a hard time looking human. I'd had one glimpse of him in his true form, and it had been nearly blinding. Since no one else in the bar was gasping at the sight of him, I knew they weren't seeing him the same way I did.
"Niall," I said, "I'm so happy to see you."
I always felt pleased and flattered when he visited. Being Niall's great-granddaughter was like being kin to a rock star. He lived a life I couldn't imagine, went places I would never go, and had power I couldn't fathom. But every now and then he spent time with me, and that time was always like Christmas. He said very quietly,
"These people opposite me, they do nothing but talk of you."
"Do you know what the FBI is?"
Niall's fund of knowledge was incredible. Since he was so old, he'd stopped counting at 1,000 and sometimes missed accurate dates by more than a century. but I didn't know how specific his information about the modern day might be.
Yes,
he said.
FBI, a government agency that collects data about lawbreakers and terrorists inside the United States.
I nodded.
But you're such a good person. You're not a killer or terrorist.
Niall said, though he didn't sound as if he believed my innocence would protect me. Thank you, I said, but I don't think they want to arrest me. I suspect they want to find out how I get results with my little mental condition, and if they decide I'm not nuts, they probably want me to work for them. That's why they came to Bon Ton, but they got sidetracked. And that brought me to the painful subject. Do you know what happened to Crystal?
But some other customers called me then, and it was a while before I got back to Niall, who was waiting patiently. He somehow made the scarred chair look like a throne. He picked the conversation up right where we'd left off.
Yes, I know what happened to her.
His face didn't seem to change, but I felt the chill rolling off of him. If I'd had anything to do with Crystal's death, I would have felt very afraid.
How come you care? I asked. He'd never paid any attention to Jason. In fact, Niall seemed to dislike my brother.
Niall said,
I'm always interested in finding out why someone connected to me has died.
Niall had sounded totally impersonal when he spoke of Crystal's death, but if he was interested, maybe he would help.
You'd think he'd want to clear Jason, since Jason was his great-grandson just as surely as I was his great-granddaughter. But Niall had never shown any sign of wanting to meet Jason, much less get to know him.
Antoine rang the bell in the kitchen to tell me one of my orders was up, and I scurried off to serve Sid Matt Lancaster and Bud Dearborn their cheesy chili bacon fries. The recently widowed Sid Matt was so old, I guess he figured his arteries couldn't harden much more than they already had, and Bud had never been one for health food. When I could return to Niall, I said,
Do you have any idea who did it? The Werepanthers are searching, too.
I put down an extra napkin on the table in front of him so I'd look busy. Niall didn't disdain the Panthers. In fact, though fairies seem to consider themselves apart and superior to all other species of supernaturals, Niall, at least, had respect for all shape-changers, unlike the vampires, who regarded them as second-rate citizens.
I'll look a little. I've been preoccupied, and that is why I haven't visited. There is trouble.
I saw that Niall's expression was even more serious than usual.
Oh, shit, more trouble.
But you need not concern yourself, he added regally. I will take care of it.
Did I mention Niall is a little proud? But I couldn't help but feel concerned. In a minute, I'd have to go get someone else another drink, and I wanted to be sure I understood him. Niall didn't come around often, and when he did, he seldom dallied. I might not get another chance to talk to him. What's up, Niall? I asked directly.
I want you to take special care of yourself. If you see any fairies other than myself or Claude and Claudine, call me at once.
Why would I worry about other fairies?
The other shoe dropped. Why would other fairies want to hurt me?
Because you are my great-granddaughter.
He stood, and I knew I'd get no more explanation than that. Niall hugged me again, kissed me again, fairies are very touchy-feely, and left the bar, his cane in his hand. I'd never seen him use it as an aid to walking, but he always had it with him. As I stared after him, I wondered if it had a knife concealed inside, or maybe it might be an extra-long magic wand, or both. I wished he could have stuck around for a while, or at least issued a more specific danger bulletin.
Miss Stackhouse, said a polite male voice.
Could you bring us another pitcher of beer and another basket of pickles?
I turned to Special Agent La Testa.
Sure, be glad to,
I said, smiling automatically.
That was a very handsome man, Sarah Weiss said.
Sarah was feeling the effects of the two glasses of beer she'd already had.
He sure looked different. Is he from Europe?
He does look foreign, I agreed, and took the empty pitcher and fetched them a full one, smiling all the while. Then Catfish, my brother's boss, knocked over a rum and coke with his elbow, and I had to call Derek to come with a washcloth for the table and a mop for the floor. After that, two idiots who'd been in my high school class got into a fight about whose hunting dog was better. Sam had to break that up. They were actually quicker to come to their senses now that they knew what Sam was, which was an unexpected bonus. A lot of the discussion in the bar that evening dealt with Crystal's death, naturally. The fact that she'd been a werepanther had seeped into the town's consciousness. About half of the bar patrons believed she'd been killed by someone who hated the newly revealed underworld. The other half wasn't so sure that she'd been killed because she was a werepanther. That half thought her promiscuity was enough motivation. Most of them assumed Jason was guilty. Some of them felt sympathy for him. Some of them had known Crystal or her reputation, and they felt Jason's actions were justifiable. Almost all of these people thought of Crystal only in terms of Jason's guilt or innocence. I found it real sad that most people would only remember her for the manner of her death. I should go see Jason or call him, but I couldn't find it in my heart. Jason's actions over the past few months had killed something in me. Though Jason was my brother, and I loved him, and he was showing signs of finally growing up, I no longer felt that I had to support him through all the trials his life had brought him. That made me a bad Christian, I realized. Though I knew I wasn't a deep theological thinker, I sometimes wondered if crisis moments in my life hadn't come down to two choices, be a bad Christian or die. I'd chosen life every time. Was I looking at this right? Was there another point of view that would enlighten me? I couldn't think of anyone to ask. I tried to imagine the Methodist minister's face if I asked him, "Would it be better to stab someone to keep yourself safe or let them go on and kill you? Would it be better to break a vow I made in front of God or refuse to break my friend's hand to bits?" These were choices I had faced. Maybe I owed God a big debt. Or maybe I was protecting myself like he wanted me to. I just didn't know, and I couldn't think deep enough to figure out the ultimate right answer. Would the people I was serving laugh if they knew what I was thinking? Would my anxiety over the state of my soul amuse them? Lots of them would probably tell me that all situations are covered in the Bible, and that if I read the book more, I'd find my answers there. That hadn't worked for me so far, but I wasn't giving up. I abandoned my circular thoughts and listened in on the people around me to give my brain a rest. Sarah Weiss thought that I seemed like a simple young woman, and she decided I was incredibly lucky to have been given a gift, as she considered it. She believed everything La Testa had told her about what had happened at the pyramid, because underneath her practical approach to life, there was a streak of mysticism. La Testa, too, thought it was almost possible I was psychic. He'd listened to accounts of the Rhodes first responders with great interest, and now that he'd met me, he'd come to think they were speaking the truth. He wanted to know what I could do for my country and his career. He wondered if he'd get a promotion if he could get me to trust him enough to be my handler throughout my time of helping the FBI. If he could acquire my male accomplice as well, his upward trajectory would be assured. He would be stationed at FBI headquarters in Washington. He would be launched up the ladder. I considered asking Amelia to lay a spell on the FBI agents, but that seemed like cheating somehow. They weren't soups. They were just doing what they'd been told to do. They didn't bear me any ill will. In fact, La Testa believed he was doing me a favor,
because he could get me out of this parish backwater and into the national limelight, or at least high in the esteem of the FBI. As if that mattered to me. As I went about my duties, smiling and exchanging chit-chat with regular customers, I tried to imagine leaving Bonton with Letesta. They'd devise some test to measure my accuracy. They'd finally believe I wasn't psychic but telepathic. When they found out what the limits of my talent were, they'd take me places where awful things had happened so I could find survivors. They'd put me in rooms with the intelligence agents of other countries or with Americans they suspected of awful things. I'd have to tell the FBI whether or not those people were guilty of whatever crime the FBI imagined they might have committed. I'd have to be close to mass murderers, maybe. I imagined what I might see in the mind of such a person, and I felt sick. But wouldn't the knowledge I gained be a great help to the living? Maybe I'd learn about plots far enough in advance to prevent deaths. I shook my head. My mind was wandering too far afield. All that might happen. A serial killer might be thinking of where his victims were buried just at the moment I was listening to his thoughts. But in my extensive experience, people seldom thought, "Yes, I buried that body at 1218 Clover Drive under the rose bush," or, "That money I stole sure is safe in my bank account numbered 12345 in Switzerland National Bank." Much less, "I'm plotting to blow up the XYZ building on May 4th, and my six Confederates are." Yes, there would be some good I could do, but whatever I could achieve would never reach the expectations of the government, and I'd never be free again. I didn't think they'd hold me in a cell or anything. I'm not that paranoid. But I didn't think I'd ever get to live my own life as I wanted. So, once again, I decided that maybe I was being a bad Christian, or at least a bad American. But I knew that unless I was forced to do so, I wasn't going to leave Bonton with Agent Weiss or Special Agent Letesta. Being married to a vampire was way better.
This ends Disc 3. Dead and Gone, Disc 4.
Chapter 8. I was mad at almost everybody when I drove home that night. Every now and then, I had spells like that. Maybe everyone does. It's hormonal or cyclical in some other way. Or maybe it's just the chance alignment of the stars. I was angry with Jason because I'd been angry with him for months. I was angry with Sam in a kind of hurt way. I was pissed at the FBI agents because they were here to put pressure on me, though in truth they hadn't done that yet. I was outraged at Eric's stunt with the knife and his high-handed banishment of Quinn, though I had to admit Eric had spoken the truth when he said I'd given Quinn the heave-ho first. That didn't mean I never wanted to see him again, or did it? It sure didn't mean that Eric could dictate to me who I saw and who I didn't. And maybe I was angry with myself, because when I'd had the chance to confront Eric about all kinds of stuff, I'd gone all goopy and listened to his reminiscences. Like the flashbacks on Lost, Eric's Viking memories had broken into the flow of the current story. To make me even angrier, there was a car I didn't recognize parked at the front door, where only visitors parked. I went to the back door and up the porch steps, frowning and feeling totally contrary. I didn't want company. All I wanted to do was put on my pajamas, wash my face, and get into bed with a book. Octavia was sitting at the kitchen table with a man I'd never met. He was one of the blackest men I'd ever seen, and his face was tattooed with circles around the eyes. Despite his fearsome decorations, he looked calm and agreeable. He rose to his feet when I came in.
"Suki," Octavia said in a trembling voice, "this is my friend Louis."
"Nice to meet you," I said, and extended my hand for him to shake. He gave mine a carefully gentle grip, and I sat down so he would. Then I noticed the suitcases sitting in the hall. "Octavia?" I said, pointing at them.
Well, Sookie, even us old ladies have some romance in our lives,
Octavia said, smiling.
Lewis and I were close friends before Katrina. He lived about 10 minutes' drive away from me in New Orleans. After it happened, I looked for him. I gave up, finally.
I spent a lot of time trying to find Octavia,
Lewis said, his eyes on her face.
I finally tracked down her niece 2 days ago, and her niece had the phone number here. I couldn't believe I'd finally found her.
Did your house survive the incident, catastrophe, disaster, apocalypse? Pick your word, they all would serve.
Yes, praise the gods, it did. And I have electricity. There's a lot to do, but I have light and heat. I can cook again. My refrigerator's humming and my street's almost clean. I put my own roof back on. Now Octavia can come home with me to a place fit for her.
Sookie, she said very gently,
you've been so kind, letting me stay with you. But I want to be with Lewis, and I need to be back in New Orleans. There'll be something I can do to help rebuild the city. It's home to me.
Octavia obviously felt she was delivering a heavy blow. I tried to look chagrined.
You have to do what's best for you, Octavia. I've loved having you in my house.
I was so grateful Octavia wasn't telepathic.
Is Amelia here?
Yes, she's upstairs getting something for me. Bless her heart, she got me a goodbye present somehow.
Aw, I said, trying not to overdo it. I got a sharp look from Lewis, but Octavia beamed at me. I'd never seen Octavia beam before, and I liked the look on her.
I'm just glad I was able to be a help to you,
she said, nodding wisely. It was a little trouble to maintain my slightly sad but brave smile, but I managed. Thank goodness Amelia clattered down the stairs at that moment with a wrapped package in her hands, a thin, flimsy red scarf tied around it and secured with a big bow. Without looking at me, Amelia said,
here's a little something from Sookie and me. I hope you enjoy it.
Oh, you're so sweet. I'm sorry I ever doubted your skill, Amelia. You're one heck of a witch.
Octavia, it means so much to me to hear you say that.
Amelia was genuinely touched and tearful. Thank goodness Lewis and Octavia got up then. Though I liked and respected the older witch, she had provided a series of speed bumps in the smooth running of the household Amelia and I had formed. I actually found myself breathing a profound sigh of relief when the front door shut on her and her partner. We'd all said goodbye to one another over and over, and Octavia had thanked both of us for various things repeatedly, and she'd also found ways to remind us of all sorts of mysterious things she'd done for us that we were having a hard time recalling.
Heavens be praised, said Amelia, collapsing on the stairs.
Amelia was not a religious woman, or at least she wasn't a conventional Christian religious woman, so this was quite a demonstration from her. I sat on the edge of the couch.
I hope they're very happy, I said. You don't think we should have checked up on him somehow?
A witch as strong as Octavia can't take care of herself.
Good point. But did you see those tattoos? They were something, weren't they? I guess he's some kind of sorcerer.
Amelia nodded. Yeah, I'm sure he practices some form of African magic, she said. I don't think we need to worry about the high crime rate in New Orleans affecting Octavia and Lewis. I don't think anyone's going to be mugging them.
What was the present we gave her?
I called my dad, and he faxed me a gift certificate to his home supply store.
Hey, good idea. What do I owe you?
Not a dime. He insisted it be on him. At least this happy incident took the edge off my generalized anger.
I felt more companionable with Amelia, too, now that I no longer harbored a vague resentment for her bringing Octavia into my house. We sat in the kitchen and chatted for about an hour before I turned in, though I was too exhausted to try to explain the saga of what had been happening lately. We went to bed better friends than we'd been in weeks. As I was getting ready for bed, I was thinking about our practical gift to Octavia, and that reminded me of the card Bobby Burnham had handed me. I got it out of my purse and slit the envelope with my nail file. I pulled out the card inside. Enclosed in it was a picture I'd never seen, clearly taken during Eric's photo shoot for the calendar you could buy in the gift shop at Fantasia. In the calendar shot, Eric, Mr. January, stood by a huge bed made up all in white. The background was gray, with glittering snowflakes hanging down all around. Eric had one foot on the floor, the other knee bent and resting on the bed. He was holding a white fur robe in a strategic position. In the picture Eric had given me today, he was in somewhat the same pose, but he was holding a hand out to the camera as if he was inviting the viewer to come join him on the bed. And the white fur wasn't covering quite everything.
"I wait for the night you join me,"
he'd written on the otherwise blank card in his crabbed handwriting. Faintly cheesy? Yes. Gulp-inducing? Oh, you betcha. I could practically feel my blood heat up. I was sorry I'd opened it right before I climbed in the bed. It definitely took me a long time to drift off to sleep. It felt funny not to hear Octavia buzzing around the house when I woke up the next morning. She'd vanished from my life as quickly as she'd entered it. I hoped that in some of their time together, Octavia and Amelia had discussed Amelia's status with what remained of her New Orleans coven. It was hard to believe Amelia could turn a young man into a cat during the course of some very adventurous sex, I thought, as I watched my roommate hurry out the back door to get to the insurance office. Amelia, dressed in navy pants and a tan and navy sweater, looked like she was ready to sell Girl Scout cookies. When the door slammed behind her, I drew a long breath. I was alone in the house for the first morning in ages. The solitude didn't last long. I was drinking a second cup of coffee and eating a toasted biscuit when Andy Belfleur and Special Agent Letesta came to the front door. I hastily pulled on some jeans and a t-shirt to answer the door. "Andy, Special Agent Letesta," I said, "come on in." I led the way back to the kitchen. I wasn't going to let them keep me away from my coffee pot. "Do you want a cup?" I asked them, but they both shook their heads.
"Sookie,"
Andy said, his face serious,
"we're here about Crystal."
"Sure." I bit off some biscuit, chewed, and swallowed. I wondered if Letesta was on a diet or something. He followed my every move. I dipped into his brain. He wasn't happy that I wasn't wearing a bra because my boobs distracted him. He was thinking I was a bit too curvy for his taste. He was thinking he'd better not think about me that way anymore. He was missing his wife. "I figured that would take priority over the other thing," I said, forcing my attention back to Andy. I couldn't tell how much Andy knew, how much Letesta had shared, about what had happened in Rhodes, but Andy nodded.
"We think,"
he said, after glancing from me to Letesta,
"that Crystal died 3 nights ago, sometime between 1 a.m. and 3 or 4 a.m.
"Sure," I said again.
"You knew that?"
Letesta went practically on point, like a bird dog. "It stands to reason. There's always someone around the bar until 1 or 2, and then normally Terry comes in to clean the floors sometime between 6 and 8 a.m. Terry wasn't coming so early that day because he'd been tending bar and needed to sleep late, but most people wouldn't think of that, right?"
"Right,"
Andy said after an appreciable pause. "So," I said, my point made, and poured myself some more coffee.
How well do you know Trey Dawson?
Andy asked. That was a loaded question. The accurate answer was, not as well as you think. I'd once been caught in an alley with Trey Dawson, and he'd been naked, but it wasn't what people thought. I'd been aware they'd thought quite a bit.
He's been dating Amelia, I said, which was pretty safe to say. She's my roommate, I reminded Letesta, who was looking a little blank. You met her 2 days ago? She's at work right now, and, of course, Trey's a werewolf.
Letesta blinked. It would take a while for him to get used to people saying that with straight faces. Andy's own expression didn't change.
Right, Andy said. Was Amelia out with Trey the night Crystal died?
I don't remember. Ask her.
We will. Has Trey ever said anything to you about your sister-in-law?
I don't recall anything. Of course, they knew each other, at least a little bit, since they were both were-animals.
How long have you known about werewolves and the other were-animals?
Andy asked, as though he just couldn't help himself.
Oh, for a while, I said. Sam first, and then others.
And you didn't tell anyone?
Andy asked incredulously.
Of course not, I said. People think I'm weird enough as it is. Besides, it wasn't my secret to tell.
It was my turn to give him a look.
Andy, you knew too.
After that night in the alley when we'd been attacked by a were-hater, Andy had at least heard Trey in his animal form and then seen him as a naked human. Any basic connect-the-dots would draw a picture of a werewolf. Andy looked down at the notepad he'd taken out of his pocket. He didn't write anything down. He took a deep breath.
So that time I saw Trey in the alley, he had just changed back? I'm kind of glad. I never figured you for the kind of woman who'd have sex in public places with someone she scarcely knew.
That surprised me. I'd always thought Andy believed just about anything bad about me.
What about that bloodhound that was with you?
That was Sam, I said, rising to rinse out my coffee cup.
But at the bar, he changed into a collie.
Collies are cute, I said. He figured more people would relate. It's his usual form.
Letesta's eyes were bugging out. He was one tightly wound guy.
Let's get back on topic, he said. Your brother's alibi seems to be true, Andy said. We've talked to Jason 2 or 3 times, and we've talked to Michelle 2 times, and she's adamant that she was with him the whole time. She told us everything that happened that night in detail.
Andy half smiled. Too much detail. That was Michelle. She was forthright and downright. Her mom was the same way. I'd gone to vacation Bible school one summer when Mrs. Schubert was teaching my age group.
Tell the truth and shame the devil, she'd advised us.
Michelle had taken that adage to heart, though maybe not in the way her mother had intended it.
I'm glad you believe her, I said.
We also talked to Calvin.
Andy leaned on his elbows.
He gave us the background on Dove and Crystal. According to him, Jason knew all about their affair.
He did. I shut my mouth tight. I wasn't going to talk about that incident if I could help it.
And we talked to Dove.
Of course.
Dove Beck, Letesta said, reading from his own notes. He's 26, married, 2 kids.
Since I knew all that, I had nothing to say.
His cousin, Alcee, insisted on being there when we talked to him,
Letesta said.
Dove says he was home all that night, and his wife corroborates that.
I don't think Dove did it, I said, and they both looked surprised.
But you gave us the lead that she and Dove had had an affair, Andy said.
I flushed with mortification.
I'm sorry I did. I hated it when everyone looked at Jason like they were sure he'd done it, when I knew he hadn't. I don't think Dove murdered Crystal. I don't think he cared enough about her to do that to her.
But maybe she ruined his marriage.
Still, he wouldn't do that. Dove would be mad at himself, not at her. And she was pregnant. Dove wouldn't kill a pregnant woman.
How can you be so sure?
Because I can read his mind and see his innocence, I thought. But the vampires and wares had come out, not me. I was hardly a supernatural creature. I was just a variation on human. I don't think that's in Dove, I said. I don't see it.
And we're supposed to accept that as proof? Letesta said.
I don't care what you do with it, I said, stopping short of offering a suggestion as to exactly what he might try. You asked me, I answered you.
So, do you think this was a hate crime?
It was my turn to look down at the table. I didn't have a notepad to scribble on, but I wanted to consider what I was about to say. Yes, I told them finally. I think it was a hate crime. But I don't know if it was personal hate because Crystal was a slut, or racial hate because she was a werepanther. I shrugged. If I hear anything, I'll tell you. I want this solved.
Hear anything? In the bar?
Letesta's expression was avid. Finally, a human man saw me as intensely valuable. Just my luck he was happily married and thought I was a freak. Yes, I said. I might hear something in the bar. They left after that, and I was glad to see them go. It was my day off. I felt I should do something special today to celebrate, since I was coming off such a difficult time, but I couldn't think of anything to do. I looked at the weather channel and saw the high for today was supposed to be in the 60s. I decided winter was officially over, even though it was still January. It would get cold again, but I was going to enjoy the day. I got my old chaise longue out of the storage shed and set it up in the backyard. I slicked my hair up in a ponytail and doubled it over so it wouldn't hang down. I put on my smallest bikini, which was bright orange and turquoise. I covered myself in tanning lotion. I took a radio and the book I was reading and a towel and went out to the yard. Yep, it was cool. Yep, I got goosebumps when a breeze came up. But this was always a happy day on my calendar. The first day I got to sunbathe. I was going to enjoy it. I needed it. Every year I thought of all the reasons I shouldn't lie out in the sun. Every year I added up my virtues. I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, and I very seldom had sex, though I was willing to change that. But I loved my sun, and it was bright in the sky today. Sooner or later I'd pay for it, but it remained my weakness. I wondered if maybe my fairy blood would give me a pass on the possibility of skin cancer. Nope, my Aunt Linda had died of cancer, and she'd had more fairy blood than I had. Well, damn it. I lay on my back, my eyes closed, dark glasses keeping the glare to a minimum. I sighed blissfully, ignoring the fact that I was a little on the cold side. I carefully didn't think about many things. Crystal, mysterious ill-wishing fairies, the FBI. After 15 minutes, I switched to my stomach, listening to the country and western station from Shreveport, singing along from time to time since no one was around to hear me. I have an awful voice.
What you doing?
Asked a voice right by my ear. I'd never levitated before, but I think I did then, rising about 6 inches off the low folding chaise. I squawked, too.
Jesus Christ, Shepherd of Judea!
I wheezed when I finally realized that the voice belonged to Diantha, part demon niece of the half-demon lawyer, Mr. Cataliades.
Diantha, you scared me so bad I almost jumped out of my skin.
Diantha was laughing silently, her lean, flat body bobbing up and down. She was sitting cross-legged on the ground, and she was wearing red Lycra running shorts and a black and green pattern T-shirt. Red Converses with yellow socks completed her ensemble. She had a new scar, a long red puckered one that ran down her left calf.
Explosion,
she said when she saw I was looking at it. Diantha had changed her hair color, too. It was a gleaming platinum, but the scar was bad enough to recapture my attention. You okay?
I asked. It was easy to adopt a terse style when you were talking to Diantha, whose conversation was like reading a telegram.
Better,
she said, looking down at the scar herself. Then her strange green eyes met mine.
My uncle sent me.
This was the prelude to the message she had come to deliver, I understood, because she said it so slowly and distinctly.
What does your uncle want to tell me?
I was still on my stomach, propped on my elbows. My breathing was back to normal.
He says the fairies are moving around in this world. He says to be careful. He says they'll take you if they can, and they'll hurt you.
Diantha blinked at me.
Why?
I asked, all my pleasure in the sun evaporating as if it had never been. I felt cold. I cast a nervous glance around the yard.
Your great-grandfather has many enemies, Diantha said slowly and carefully.
Diantha, do you know why he has so many enemies? That was a question I couldn't ask my great-grandfather himself, or at least I hadn't worked up the courage to do so. Diantha looked at me quizzically.
They're on one side, he's on the other,
she said, as if I were slow.
They got your grandfather.
These other fairies killed my grandfather Fenton? She nodded vigorously.
He didn't tell you,
she said. Niall? He just said his son had died. Diantha broke into a hoot of shrill laughter.
You could say that,
she said, and doubled over, still laughing.
Chopped into pieces?
She slapped me on the arm in her excess of amusement. I winced.
Sorry,
she said.
Sorry.
Okay, I said. Just give me a minute. I rubbed the arm vigorously to restore the feeling. How did you protect yourself if marauding fairies were after you?
Who exactly am I supposed to be scared of? I asked.
Brandon,
she said.
It means something I forgot.
Oh, what does Niall mean? Easily sidetracked, that was me.
Cloud,
Diantha said.
All Niall's people got sky names.
Okay, so Brandon is after me. Who is he? Diantha blinked. This was a very long conversation for her.
Your great-grandfather's enemy,
she explained carefully, as if I were very dense.
The only other fairy prince.
Why did Mr. Cataliades send you?
Did your best,
she said in one breath. Her unblinking bright eyes latched onto mine, and she nodded and very gently patted my hand. I had done my best to get everyone out of the pyramid alive, but it hadn't worked. It was kind of gratifying to know that the lawyer appreciated my efforts. I'd spent a week being angry at myself because I hadn't uncovered the whole bombing plot more quickly. If I'd paid more attention, hadn't let myself get so distracted by the other stuff going on around me.
Also, your check will come.
Oh, good. I could feel myself brighten despite the worry caused by the rest of Diantha's message. Did you bring a letter for me or anything like that? I asked, hoping for a little more enlightenment. Diantha shook her head, and the gelled spikes of her bright platinum hair trembled all over her head, making her look like an agitated porcupine.
Uncle has to stay neutral, she said clearly.
No paper, no phone calls, no emails. That's why he sent me.
Cataliades had really stuck his neck out for me. No, he'd stuck Diantha's neck out. What if they capture you, Diantha? I said. She shrugged a bony shoulder.
Go down fighting,
she said. Her face grew sad. Though I can't read demon minds in the same way I can read human ones, any fool could tell Diantha was thinking about her sister, Gladiola, who had died from the sweep of a vampire's sword. But after a second, Diantha looked simply lethal.
Burn 'em, Diantha said.
I sat up and raised my eyebrows to show I didn't understand. Diantha turned her hand up and looked at the palm. A tiny flicker of flame hovered right above it.
I didn't know you could do that, I said.
I was not a little impressed. I reminded myself to always stay on Diantha's good side.
Little,
she said, shrugging. I deduced from that that Diantha could make only a small flame, not a large one. Gladiola must have been taken completely by surprise by the vampire who'd killed her, because vampires were flammable, much more so than humans.
Do fairies burn like vamps?
She shook her head.
But everything'll burn, she said, her voice certain and serious. Sooner, later.
I suppressed a shiver. Do you want a drink or something to eat? I asked.
Nah.
She got up from the ground, dusted off her brilliant outfit.
I gotta go.
She patted me on the head and turned, and then she was gone, running faster than any deer. I lay back down on the chaise to think about all this. Now Niall had warned me, Mr. Catalyades had warned me, and I felt well and truly scared. But the warnings, though timely, didn't give me any practical information about how to guard against this threat. It might materialize at any time or in any place, as far as I could tell. I could assume the enemy fairies wouldn't storm Merlot's and haul me out of there, since the Fae were so secretive. But other than that, I didn't have a clue about what form the attack would take or how to defend myself. Would locked doors keep fairies out? Did they have to be granted entry like vampires? No, I couldn't recall having to tell Niall he could come in, and he'd been to the house. I knew fairies weren't limited to the night, as the vamps were. I knew they were very strong as vampires. I knew the Fae who were actual fairies, as opposed to the Fae who were brownies or goblins or elves, were beautiful and ruthless. That even vampires respected the ferocity of the fairies. The oldest fairies didn't always live in this world, as Claudine and Claude did. There was somewhere else they could go, a shrinking and secret world they found vastly preferable to this one, a world without iron. If they could limit their exposure to iron, fairies lived so long that they couldn't keep track of the years. Niall, for example, tossed around hundreds of years in his conversational chronology in a very inconsistent way. He might describe some event as being 500 years ago, when another event that predated it was earmarked 200 years ago. He simply couldn't keep track of the passage of time, maybe partly because he didn't spend most of that time in our world. I racked my brain for any other information. I did know one other thing, and I couldn't believe I'd forgotten it even momentarily. If iron is bad for fairies, lemon juice is even worse. Claude and Claudine's sister had been murdered with lemon juice. Now that I thought of them, I thought it might be helpful for me to talk to Claude and Claudine. Not only were they my cousins, but Claudine was my fairy godmother, and she was supposed to help me. She'd be at work at the department store where she handled complaints and wrapped packages and took layaway payments. Claude would be at the male strip club he now owned and managed. He'd be easier to reach. I went inside to look up the number. Claude actually answered the phone himself.
Yes,
he said, managing to convey indifference, contempt, and boredom in the one word.
Hi, sweetie, I said brightly. I need to talk to you face to face. Can I run over there, or are you busy?
No, don't come here.
Claude sounded almost alarmed at the idea.
I'll meet you at the mall.
The twins lived in Monroe, which boasted a nice mall.
Okay, I said. Where and when?
There was a moment of silence.
Claudine can get off late for lunch. We'll meet you in an hour and a half in the food court around Chick-fil-A.
See you there,
I said, and Claude hung up. Mr. Charm. I hustled into my favorite jeans and a green and white t-shirt. I brushed my hair vigorously. I found it a lot of trouble to deal with, but I couldn't bring myself to cut it. Since I'd exchanged blood with Eric several times, not only had I not caught so much as a cold, but I didn't even have split ends. Plus, my hair was shinier and actually looked thicker. I wasn't surprised that people bought vampire blood on the black market. It did surprise me that people were foolish enough to trust the sellers when they said that the red stuff was actually genuine vampire blood. Often the vials contained true blood, or pig's blood, or even the drainer's own blood. If the purchaser did get genuine vampire blood, it was aged and might easily drive the consumer mad. I would never have gone to a drainer to buy vampire blood.